From KCRW, you're listening to Greater LA, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. Hi, I'm Steve Chitakis.
All right, let's go speak with Mom.
On a recent morning, LA Unified Superintendent Alberto Carvalho approaches this one-story Gardena home of Daisy Morales.
Good morning, good morning. Good morning.
Nice to meet you.
It's a pleasure meeting you.
The superintendent, tailed by a half dozen reporters with TV cameras and microphones, he wants to help. Morales' three school-aged kids missed 62 days of school last year.
This year, I'm trying my best. I'm not going to look back. I'm not looking back.
This visit is part of LAUSD's campaign to boost attendance called I Attend. Administrators, principals, and attendance counselors knocked on the doors of 9,000 homes last school year, and they're continuing the effort this year.
We descend upon these families, connect with them, and we bring the resources with rapid solutions to address the issues facing these families and their students.
Student absences soared during the pandemic. During the 2021 school year, two out of every five kids at LA Unified missed at least 10% of school days. The district is treating this chronic absenteeism like a crisis. Slowly, slowly, attendance is starting to recover, but not because Carvalho is doing press conferences in people's homes. It's because of the tireless work of attendance counselors at local schools who are leading the effort to get kids back in the classroom. Classrooms like the ones at 135th Street Elementary School in Gardena, where KCRW's Robin Estrin picks up the story.
It's 7:40 a.m., and attendance counselor Yasmin Arias is greeting kids at the gates of 135th Street Elementary School, as she does every morning.
Hi, son. Ooh, I like your hair.
Thank you.
Who did that, your mama? Hi, Guadalupe.
Today is a special day, Fun Friday. As kids wearing nearly kid-sized backpacks file by, Arias hands each of them a red paper ticket.
Hi, Elias. Hi, Lucas. Have a happy Fun Friday.
Later, the kids who showed up to school on time will exchange these red tickets for a prize.
A pencil, eraser, sharpener, everything's happiness. They're just happy to get anything.
Fun Friday is part of the elementary school's strategy to recover attendance, which plummeted during the pandemic. Schools in LAUSD were closed or operating on a hybrid basis for a year and a half. Cherie Lewis Devon is the principal of 135th Street. She says it's been hard to get kids back in the habit of going to school every day.
At first, it was difficult. Our attendance was really, really bad. Some wanted to stay on virtual learning because they became comfortable with learning from a device at home in the comfort of their home.
Another habit that's been hard to break, staying home from school when you're even mildly sick. During the pandemic, kids weren't allowed on campus with any symptoms at all. The district only reversed that policy at the start of this school year.
After COVID, parents became very sensitive to anything with health related.
Arias says parental confusion about when to keep a kid home is the biggest barrier to healthy attendance. But families at 135th Street and across the district are up against barriers to attendance that predate the pandemic, barriers that are more common in low-income schools. Daisy Morales, the parent you heard from earlier, struggles daily with transportation. She doesn't drive, and she says her kids don't feel safe on the city bus.
So it's hard for me to get a ride every morning for them. My budget, my money is low. I don't work. So sometimes I'm like, you guys got to take the bus, but I don't want to, and I don't want them to miss school anymore.
Arias says that for a lot of parents, work schedules get in the way.
I have a lot of parents who work at nighttime, and then in the morning, I'm like the wake-up. I'm their wake-up alarm. I would keep calling. Until they wake up.
She says custody issues are also driving a lot of absences.
They're like, oh, the dad wanted to pick them up a few days earlier, so then they won't come because the father took them out of town so he can spend more time with them. So that's another barrier as well.
Arias says a lot of the parents at 135th are trying their best.
It's hard for them to think about school when they have their survival needs that comes first.
Slowly, though, Arias has worked to turn the school's attendance story around. Last August, 19% of the kids at 135th Street were chronically absent. This August, that number dropped to 7%. Arias attributes the success to two things. The first is rewarding kids who come to school with the things they really want, toys and treats.
I found a pencil of gummy bears.
Dozens of elementary kids popped by Arias's office to pick up an attendance prize on Fun Friday. Why do you think it's important to come to school every day?
Because so you can grab prizes.
And how about learning? Is that important?
Yes, so you can grow up and you can be whatever you want.
Arias's other major attendance strategy is making meaningful and persistent connections with parents.
You have to understand that the problems are not going to go away just because you did one intervention, one resource. There's so many layers, so you have to listen to their story and kind of handhold.
Just ahead of the tardy bell, parent Morales drops her youngest daughter off at the school. Morales has been applying for jobs, and Arias has something for her.
Okay. Are you in a rush?
No.
No? Okay. Let me just see if
She runs off and returns with an armful of blazers and skirts in Morales's size.
This is the professional attire that was donated by our teacher.
The suits are heavy, so Arias offers to deliver them to Morales' home after school.
Are you going to be home all day?
Yeah.
Yeah? I'll take it to you before around 3 o'clock.
Okay,
I'll stop by and I'll drop them off.
Okay.
Then Arias offers Morales more help with her job search.
Did they ask you for a resume?
Yes.
I'll get you a template and then you can kind of like fill me in as to what it is so I can then print it for you and give it to you. Yeah.
From there, Arias hustles from the tardy line back to her office. She still needs to run her attendance report and call the parents of kids who didn't show up to school today to see what's going on. She says she loves her job, but it also takes a toll on her.
There's just so many requests, and there's one of me, so I guess the hardest part is understanding, like, not being hard on myself. Sometimes I'm like, oh my God, I didn't get to this person. But then I have to remember, no, we'll take care of it tomorrow.
It's a lot of work, but her efforts are paying off. Just one example, Daisy Morales' daughter has shown up to school at 135th Street Elementary almost every day this year. For KCRW, I'm Robin Estrin.
Well, when those students do make it to school these days, music education isn't as prominent as it once was. Coming up, hear from one higher profile musician who wants to help change that right after this short break.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
More now from Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chitakis. You might know musician Tom Morello from songs like this one. That's Rage Against the Machine. As the guitarist for one of rock music's most iconic bands, Morello is used to working up crowds at music festivals and arenas, and even picket lines. He's a famously dedicated political activist. But this year, he's also shredding his guitar in a lot of school auditoriums. That's because he's partnered with Music Will. That's a nonprofit looking to launch music programs at public schools all across the United States. Just yesterday, he visited a school right here in LA, and he joins us now to talk about it. Hi, Tom.
Hey, how's it going?
Going all right. Thank you so much for coming on and talking with us.
My pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
What exactly do you do with Music Will?
So they contacted me a couple of years ago and wanted to give me something called a humanitarian award. I said, that sounds fine. But what the award means is you get to open music programs in 20 schools that need them around the country, and you get to pick them. And I was like, well, that sounds incredible, and I would love to do that. And so the first one we opened yesterday at Van Nuys High School, and the program is fantastic. Is what it basically does is it acknowledges the fact that everyone has a musical artist within them. There's often a lot of barriers to bringing out, like lessons might be hard, they might be expensive, your school might not have a music program. And so they really make it completely accessible for every person to play any sort of music they like, create music, write music, learn their favorite songs, etc. Music has been so life-changing and transforming and healing and redemptive for me to be able to share a little bit of that with the kids at Van Nuys High School is fantastic. We got 19 more schools to go.
So the reaction, I can imagine when you go there, what are they, 16, 17 years old? So do they even know who you are?
Yeah, well, so, you know, like, fortunately, the Rage and Audioslave songs have made their way in the world and whatnot. But basically how the program goes is there were some musicians from the school who actually performed and to set the whole thing off. Then I did a little bit of a Q&A, and then I played some shredding guitar for them, and then got you know, hundreds of the high school kids up on stage with me for a version of Woody Guthrie's This Land Is Your Land.
Aww.
We unveiled the gear, and then they brought it back to the sort of music room and began jamming on it.
What happened to music in the classroom, Tom? I mean, it used to be, I mean, it was one of the fundamentals, right? And now it's like, no, we just want the basics in the classroom, and that's all we can afford, really.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that your last sentence there explains it all. And that's why, thank goodness, that there are organizations like Music Will that are helping to sort of rectify that. I mean, I know for me, like, music was both an inspiration and a life raft. When I was 9, 10 years old, I took French horn lessons at my middle school, and I was horrible, and it made me think that music wasn't for me. I had an electric guitar when I was 13 years old. I took two lessons where they wanted me to, I wanted to learn like Kiss and Led Zeppelin songs, and they wanted to me to learn how to tune the guitar and play the C major scale. And I didn't touch the guitar for 4 more years because I was so turned off from it. Music Will does the exact opposite, where, you know, your first time picking up an instrument, you'll learn the Metallica song that you like, or write a song that sounds like Metallica. Like it, you know, they provide the kind of music programs that the kids want. And if they want to make hip hop beats, or if they want to sing country and western songs, or if they want to be a heavy metal drummer, all of that's available to them. And the first one was yesterday in Van Nuys, as I said. And then a couple of weeks, we're opening one at a grade school in Harlem. I was born in Harlem. And then a little bit after that, Marseilles, Illinois, which is the coal mining town that the Morellos are from in central Illinois. We're going to do the next one there.
So this is personal. This is like, and you use the term life raft, which really does mean a lot when it comes to music and like how it can really change your life.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's for people who feel a little sort of outside of the mainstream and in whatever way, music is a tether to like-minded souls. And then when you actually are able to find expression through an instrument or playing in a band and that sort of camaraderie and the chemistry, there's really nothing like it, you know? And I think that young people really need to be able to tap into their own creativity, their own expression to help them determine who they are, who they want to be. And, you know, it's a lever for social change. For me, it was, you know, it was groups like Public Enemy and The Clash that made me realize I was not alone in my crazy leftist worldview opinions in the conservative town that I lived in. And it made me think that maybe, you know, history was not just something that you can read about, that history is something you can make.
Let's talk about Tom Morello, the activist. This is at Music Will's Benefit Gala this year. Here's what you had to say.
And no matter what is put before us, whenever the world has changed, it has been changed by people who are no different. They don't have more money, power, expertise, anything than anyone in this room tonight. Anyone in this room tonight. They've stood up in their place and time to demand a more just humanity for themselves.
And, you know, music and musicians, they used to have a bigger voice, it seems like, in cultural and social change and in this country's political life. And, you know, you go back to the 60s and 70s and wow, there was a lot of change going on, right? And music was sort of at the heart of it. Do you feel that today?
Well, certainly not at the top of the charts. There are important artists you know, sort of flying the flag for identity and sexual orientation issues and things like that, which are very political and are very necessary. On the one hand, the digitization of music has made it much more democratic, where you, me, and the guy down the hall can all have, you know, albums out. 100,000 new songs come out a day on Spotify. 100,000 new songs. So there are many songs that are with political intent, with the intent to change the world, but they might not have the backing of some major label like U2 did or Rage Against the Machine did.
Congratulations, by the way, on your induction into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. That's coming up, right? In a couple of weeks.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, the day before the inauguration is when we're opening the music school in Harlem. So that's a pretty nice twofer right there.
Right. I mean, does it make you feel too much like you've become a part of the establishment? You're not raging against the machine. You're not the machine, Tom, are you?
Dude. I mean, I'm in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame with NWA, Public Enemy, The Clash, Iggy Pop and the Stooges, Patti Smith, people who have, you know, very much, you know, changed my life. I'm very, very proud of that.
What do you hope that kids attending all these programs will take away? When they see Tom Morello from Harlem, grew up in, you know, the Morello family from Illinois, you know, all of that.
What I hope they take away is a growing realization that they are agents of history. You know, as I said in that thing, like whenever the world has changed, it's changed by people who are no different than any of those kids in the classroom, you know. And for me, one of the fuses that lit that idea was music. First listening to it and then playing it and feeling that I had agency and that like there were groups like Public Enemy and The Clash who were telling the truth, who were speaking honestly and expressing themselves, you know, like through an art form that was so awesome and kick ass. And maybe I could express myself in the same way.
Well, congratulations to you and good luck, by the way, in getting the word out. We do appreciate it. And by the way, Tom Morello, we're going to play you out with a performance you did with some of those kids from the Music Will program. This one, it was a little while back, the iconic Woody Guthrie song, This Land Is Your Land. Tom Morello, guitarist for Rage Against the Machine. Tom, thank you.
Thank you very much. Here's a little Woody Guthrie.
As I was walking that ribbon of highway, I saw above me that endless skyway. I saw below me a golden valley. This land was made for you and me. This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island. From the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. As I was walking, I saw a sign there. That sign said, private property. On the other side, it didn't say nothing. That sign was made for you and me. Come on! This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Times.
Moving on now with Greater LA from KCRW, I'm Steve Chiotakis. If you head on over to the Matthew Marks Gallery on Santa Monica Boulevard in West Hollywood, you might find yourself right at home. Artist Alex DeCorte has transformed the gallery into what looks like a house from the 1960s. There's a wired landline telephone and a conversation pit, even the soiled footprints of a cat who knocked a plant onto the carpet. Our art insider, Lindsay Preston-Zappas, is editor-in-chief of Contemporary Art Review LA, and she's here to tell us more about the show. Hi, Lindsay.
Hey, Steve.
Oh, we're just at home with Alex DeCorte. You actually visited the show recently. Describe what's going on.
Yeah, so you're definitely set into this very striking environment right when you walk into the gallery. The gallery has been carpeted in this white carpet, so it feels instantly very domestic, but at the same time very sterile because it's white and you're kind of concerned to walk, you know, get it dirty. And then in the middle of the room, there's this conversation pit, as you mentioned, so this kind of classic like 60s, 70s mod aesthetic, and a couple of steps that kind of go down into this living room area. And in that space, the artist has kind of imagined this sort of like 70s era mod furniture and created these colorful flocked sculptures. And, you know, if you imagine the room is carpeted in white, the walls are white, these objects just burst into color and really contrast the rest of the show. And they're sort of like pill-shaped forms, round forms that loosely resemble lamps. There's these kind of pods, different things. So they're not literal domestic objects, but I was told that some of these objects were inspired by Stanley Kubrick's Space Odyssey. Mm. So they definitely have that kind of like futuristic, surreal quality. And then at the center of these objects is this kind of faux houseplant sculpture that's been knocked over. And we see these three little soiled cat prints that are kind of stepping away from this plant and on this pristine white carpet. And, you know, the artist kind of sets up this tableau or this kind of dreamlike narrative.
Oh, the cats. Oh, the cats that like to make a mess. You know, all of this, it seems very domestic, right? We're talking about like, this is just a day in the life, right? A snapshot. How does he do that?
You know, I think it's really interesting the way that he approaches his subject matter. You know, we're talking about these domestic cues, you know, the carpet, the conversation pit. But Decorte is really oblique in how he thinks about his references. So, for instance, there's this photographic piece in the show that's taken from a news story about a man in Tucson, Arizona, who was locked out of his house and apparently tried to enter through his chimney. And then he ended up needing rescue from the fire department. So Decorte took this news story photo where there's this man kind of covered in black soot and being helped out by firefighters. He ended up getting rescued. But in the show, Decorte removes the firefighters. So you only see this sort of blackened figure that looks almost like a statue against the blue sky background. You know, so this piece, is it about home? You know, it's about a man and his relationship to his home in a way, but it's a very particular way to think about home. So again, I think Decorte is really interested in these kind of dreamlike connections to the themes that he approaches.
Could have been Santa Claus. Maybe some Christmas theme there, stuck in the chimney. Although Santa never gets stuck in the chimney, Lindsay.
Exactly.
Let's talk about the demon, right? This is the name of the show, right? We don't really see anything about demons in this piece other than, you know, maybe the cat knocked over, right, and made a mess. Break down what's going on here as far as the demon goes.
Yeah, so this piece also very much directly references the home. So it's this large wall piece that the show is titled after. It's made up of multiple panels, sort of reads like a comic book. The work was actually inspired by this home design book from the 70s that kind of walks you through how to design a home. And each panel in the piece, you see this kind of black and white instructional diagram that involves domestic space and lighting, and many of them involve a man sitting in the space. But then, of course, from cell to cell, we see that cat. We see this black cat sort of running through the frames, and he sort of almost feels like the interloper between all these scenes. And in some of them, he actually knocks over the lighting. So again, it calls back to those kind of, those like mischievous little paw prints we saw in the gallery space. In terms of the title, I know that demons in Greek mythology are sort of like lesser deities. So somewhere between mortals and gods. And you know, you would usually personify abstract concepts like love or darkness. So, you know, I think the title, The Demon, in this work, again, is a bit abstract, but is sort of maybe meant to represent the concept of home or the domestic, sort of in that mythological sense. But again, I think with his work, it doesn't really need to build into any clear message here.
So yes, there's a lot of visuals going on here, like a visual explosion of so many things happening at the same time. By the way, the show is up through November 4th, so just a couple more weeks to go at Matthew Marks in West Hollywood. Lindsay Preston Zappas, founder and editor-in-chief of Contemporary Art Review LA. Lindsay, as always, thanks.
Thanks, Steve.
That's going to do it for us today. Tomorrow, Halloween kicks off the holiday spending season. Thanksgiving, Hanukkah, Christmas. What does that look like for the mom and pop shops on Magnolia Boulevard, Burbank's so-called Horror Row? That's tomorrow. You can find us online today and anytime at kcrw.com/GLA. Share what's on your mind. Tell us how you're doing. Maybe even suggest a story. Grab the podcast, of course, by searching KCRW Greater LA, anywhere you get your podcasts. Zoe Matthews, Celine Mendiola, Kelsey Gante, Eddie Sun, Ted Robbins, Sonia Geis, Ray Guarna, Amy Ta, Carlos Ramirez, Mike Vogel, and Christian Bordall all helped put this evening's episode together. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Thanks for your time. Thanks for that ear. Have a great night.